Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Charles Cutillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today I'm pleased to be talking to Professor Victor Bulmer Thomas, specialist in 20th century Latin American history and a past director at Chatham House. We are speaking today about his newest book, Empire in Retreat, The Past, Present, and Future of the United States. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you.
Professor, what is the primary thesis of your book?
That the United States became an empire based on territory fairly soon after independence, that this territorial empire eventually transformed itself into an empire based on institutions rather than territory, and that these institutions are now less able to be controlled by the United States, so that the empire itself is in retreat.
What is your response to someone like, say, Anthony Hopkins, economic historian at Cambridge, who argues that prior to the American Civil War, 1861-1865, the United States could be said to have been a sort of in a neo-colonial relationship vis-a-vis the UK?
Well, I've read his book, his new book, and it's very impressive in many ways, but I definitely disagree with that, because if you look at the rivalry between the United Kingdom and the United States in those years, it's not at all clear that the United Kingdom got its own way. On the contrary, if you look at a whole series of issues in Central America to do with the control of a possible future canal, it's very clear that the United States, if anything, was more powerful a player than the United Kingdom.
And on the same subject, I take it you would not agree with his thesis in his newest book, American Empire, that in the post-1945 period, the USA, while one can characterize it as being a hegemonic, if not the hegemonic empire, power, was not per se an empire in the normative sense that one uses that description for, say, the UK in the 19th century or the first half of the 20th century having an imperial power, imperial structure.
No, I don't agree with that. And I don't agree with it for a number of reasons. The first is that it's very misleading, I think, to reduce empire simply to the control of territory. Empires, even territorial empires, have always found other ways of imposing their will on other parts of the world, and it can take the place of protectorates, it can take the place of client states, control of institutions, and so on and so forth. And whatever of these dimensions you look at, the United States was clearly more than hegemonic in the post-1945 period. And specifically, it was very clear that it was trying to set out a series of institutions in which the United States would have a privileged position and which would allow it to impose its will, if you like, on the rest of the world without the need for traditional territories and colonies and so on.
Can you explicate a bit for the audience your statement on page 6 that the United States' quote, informal empire is much less extensive than it was 20 years ago, unquote?
The number of countries that look to the United States for leadership in world affairs is clearly shrinking, and that has come about for a large number of reasons. If you think of Latin America and the Caribbean, for example, the United States 20 years ago could almost invariably count on the support of a majority of countries in order to seek, through the Organization of American States or whatever it was, a policy that worked in the interests of the United States. It can't do that any longer because there are relatively few countries in Latin America that will that do look to the United States for leadership in the way that they did before. That is now becoming true in Asia as well, and it's certainly true of the Middle East for a very long time.
Now, can you flesh out a bit in a more empirical fashion your statement that, that the quote, semi-global empire is retreating?
Yes. Well, first of all, let me explain what I mean by semi-global, because given that the empire that the United States forged after the Second World War never included the Soviet Union, and within a few years would not include the People's Republic of China, it's clearly misleading to refer to it as global, and that's true whether you refer to global hegemony or global empire or whatever it is. So I use this phrase semi-global, which is perhaps not the the most attractive description, but I think is probably pretty accurate. Now, as to why that empire is in retreat, it comes down to, first of all, some basic issues to do with empire, which is that they all eventually come to an end, and they do so for a mixture of internal and external reasons. And in the United States, we can see both forces at work. Certainly on the internal side, there is less appetite, if you like, for carrying the burdens of empire than there was in the past. I see the victory of President Trump in 2016 as, in a way, an illustration of the unwillingness of a large part of the U.S. electorate to pay the imperial burden, to pay that price any longer. And looking outside the United States at the external forces at work, it's clear that with the U.S. as a shrinking part of the world economy, other countries, notably China, and are in a much stronger position now to both resist U.S. pressures, but also, to some extent, to impose their own agenda on world affairs.
Can you, although you've discussed it a little bit, can you flesh out your statement that the U.S. built an empire, quote, upon institutional rather than territorial control, unquote?
Yes, very much so. The origin of the empire is territorial, and I see the expansion across the United States as very much an exercise in territorial imperialism, in just the same way that Russia expanded across the Eurasian continent in the 18th and 19th century. But of course, just as in the case of Russia, eventually these territories became absorbed into the Union as states, leaving a relatively small number of territories outside the Union, and places like Puerto Rico and Guam and the Northern Mariana Islands and so on. So clearly that isn't sufficient to justify referring to the United States as an empire just by looking at the territories that it still controls. So what I talk about in the book is the very deliberate attempt, which actually started in the 19th century, in the late 19th century, to craft institutions in which the United States would have a privileged position, and through those institutions allow it to exercise very much the privileges of empire. It began first in the continent of the Americas, as you would expect, with the formation of various organizations of American states, initially called by different names, through the system of judicial courts set up for the Central American countries, based in Washington, with judges appointed by the United States, and all that sort of thing. But of course, that was just for the Americas. What's interesting is that after Woodrow Wilson's failure to established the United States as a key member within the League of Nations because it wasn't ratified by the Senate, that process then had to be postponed until after the Second World War. But when it happened, the United States was in such a strong position vis-a-vis all the other countries that it was able to establish, with relatively little resistance, a set of institutions in which it did have a privileged position, like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the United Nations Security Council, and later on in the trade organizations, and of course in NATO itself.
And but isn't it the fact that in the case of Latin America, up to 1939 at least, the United States, even though you could argue, or people do posit, that it was a hegemon or regional hegemon vis-a-vis Latin America, that it was the UK rather than the USA which was the primary trading partner for most of these countries, as well as the financier in terms of raising capital?
No, that's not true. The United States had achieved parity with the United Kingdom even before the First World War, when it came to the importance of trade and investment links with Latin America. And were it not for the very special position that the United Kingdom had in Argentina, if you exclude Argentina, then the United States was more important than the UK by the time the First World War started. And obviously, it became much more important after that, even including Argentina.
But was that true also in places like Brazil? The issue, of course, being that until 1914, U.S. banks were not allowed to have branches overseas.
Yes, that's correct. But if you look at the trade relations, the United States obviously the United States trading position was less important as you go south. So it was the most important in Mexico, Central America, the Caribbean, very important in Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, Peru, and then less important as you go south, through Brazil and eventually into Argentina. And you're quite right that the restrictions on U.S. branch banking abroad up to 1914 did impose some limitations. But ultimately, even allowing for that, the U.S. had become stronger in Latin America as a whole than the United Kingdom by the First World War.
Now, going into the post-1945 period, you give prominent attention to non-state actors who could be said to have underpinned the American empire. Who were these non-state actors and how do they operate?
Yes, I give a huge amount of importance to that because clearly an empire based on institutions does require reinforcing in all sorts of ways, both inside and outside the country. And inside the country, i.e. inside the United States, these non-state actors have played a crucial role. They come in various categories. I talk about the role of the U.S. multinational corporations, which had a sort of symbiotic relationship with the federal government for many decades after the Second World War, much less so now, of course. They reinforced each other's needs and requirements. And you can't say that one dominated the other. It's that they had a symbiotic relationship. I also talk about a very close relationship between the United States federal government and the media, the mainstream media, at a time when, of course, mainstream media was mainly print, radio, and television, and the largely supportive role that the mainstream media gave to the imperial ambitions of the U.S. government. I talk about the role of the think tanks and of the international grant-giving bodies such as the Ford Foundation, which also played an extremely supportive role. And finally, to the religious organizations, and in particular, the evangelical organizations, which again played a key role in underpinning this post-war empire based on institutions.
In your discussion of American relationship vis-a-vis Western Central Europe after 1945, you appears to me to ignore the rather extensive literature. I'm thinking in particular of Geir Lundstedt, Victoria de Gracia. In the case of Geir Lundstedt, he has came up with this rather pertinent phrase, empire by imitation, that it was West European countries who were anxious that United States, in as it were, establish a hegemonic position rather than the converse.
Well, I'm familiar with that literature, and I have great respect for it. So I wouldn't say I ignore it, but it's true that I don't fully agree with it. Not that it wasn't something that most Western European countries didn't support. Of course they did. But the fact is that this was very much in the interests of the United States as well. So now, although history is being rewritten to some extent by arguing that the United States, you know, has been dragged unwillingly into the support of Western European security and defense interests and all the rest of it, the fact is that after the Second World War, it was very much in the United States' interest that Europe should play a supportive role in this expanding American empire. And the United States went to enormous lengths to make sure that that was the case, including manipulating elections in France and Italy.
In the same section of the book, you also appear to disparage what is termed the special relationship between the USA and the UK in the post-45 period. But isn't there a good body of literature? I'm thinking people like Robin Edmonds and John Young, among others, who show in their scholarly treatments that the UK enjoyed a closeness in the formulation of American policy that by all standards was unprecedented as well as unparalleled, no other outside power vis-a-vis the USA having anywhere near the amount of access in terms of policy formulation as well as influence.
No, I don't agree with that at all. I don't think that empires can afford to have special relations, certainly not a semi-global empire. They cannot afford to have a special relationship in that sense with any single country, because to do so would then cause enormous problems with other countries. In fact, US presidents have been quite cautious about using the phrase special relationship in relation to the UK until after they've ceased to be in office. It's very different in the UK, which constantly talks about the special relationship as if it was somehow a given in transatlantic relationships. It's really difficult to point to any area where the United Kingdom has changed the position of the United States from something that it was going to do anyway. And there are plenty of examples where the United States has castigated the United Kingdom for doing something which it disapproved of.
Oh, isn't there an example? Well, one of the pertinent examples in this literature is NATO, or the formulation of a West European military bloc. Apparently, again, the literature is rather extensive, that the primary motivating force initially was the UK in terms of getting the United States interested in 1948.
Well, again, that's something that is quite easy to challenge, because from the time of the launch of the Truman Doctrine, it was clear that the United States was going to need some sort of defense umbrella, security umbrella, in which to exercise its ambitions in that particular direction. What the United Kingdom has always been very clever at is anticipating the directions in which US policy is going and kind of taking credit when it goes in that direction anyway. But certainly whether it comes to NATO or the Bretton Woods institutions or other things like that, I really am not persuaded that the United Kingdom has played such a crucial role. And if you now look at the For example, the really brilliant and detailed accounts of the Bretton Woods Conference, the way in which the United States marginalized the British delegation led by John Maynard Keynes is quite extraordinary and is totally different from the kind of official version that we had in the United Kingdom for many years, that the UK was an equal partner with the United States.
On page 198, you make reference to South Korea as a, quote, American protectorate, unquote. Isn't that a bit of an exaggeration?
No, I don't think so. I think when your defense is in the hands of a foreign power, you cannot be other than a protectorate. Of course, South Korea has gone on to be an enormous economic success, in large part because of the support that it received from the United States. But I think part of the definition of a sovereign state is that it is responsible for its own defense, and South Korea is not.
Yes, but when one employs the word protector, one thinks more or less of, say, Egypt between 1882 and 1922, rather than South Korea.
Well, again, you have, I mean, Egypt's protectorate status was written into a bilateral treaty with the United Kingdom, and South Korea's protectorate status, from my point of view, is written into the bilateral defense and security treaty with the United States.
In your account of the near Middle East in the post-45 period, you seem to ignore the fact that the U.S. had no military bases in the area between 1962 and 1980, and that prior to 62, it only had one military base, which was in Saudi Arabia, a rather insignificant Air Force base.
Well, I'm not sure it was insignificant. Certainly, it wasn't seen that way by either Saudi Arabia or the United States. Of course, you're looking at a period where, for many years, the United States was able to work through the bases that the United Kingdom had in that area. And therefore, it's, if you like, empire at one remove. But it's still empire because the United States was in a very strong position to ensure that the United Kingdom was acting in such a way as to promote U.S. interests in that area. And that's true of Bahrain and other places where the British had military bases at that time.
You characterize the American invention in the Lebanon in 1958 as, quote, an invasion, unquote. Is that entirely accurate? After all, the Americans were invited in by the Lebanese president, Shamoun.
Yes, I think it's accurate. Sometimes difficult to determine to what degree an invitation is a true expression of independence and to what extent it's something that's forced upon the country. There have been many times when the United States has intervened by invitation, quote unquote, but effectively it's been a U.S. decision over which the other countries had no control.
Could it be argued that, per contra to your statement in the book, that CENTO, the Near East or Middle Eastern version or attempted version of NATO, was not per se a sort of handmaiden of American hegemony or imperialism, but in fact British in origin? I mean, the British, the ones who, with the Iraqis, are the ones who first formulated the entity, and the Americans in 1955, the Americans were reluctant to get involved at all and only became a member of the organization in 1958, by which time, after the downfall of the monarchy in Iraq, it was sort of a damp squib.
Well, the Middle East is always an area where the United States has had difficulty projecting itself as an empire because it faced established imperial interests not just the British, but also the French. And it also had to deal with the Soviet Union after the Second World War. So it's not surprising that the United States worked through proxies, and the British were the most reliable from their point of view, and therefore they were happy to give the British a very substantial role in what they were achieving to achieve in the Middle East. But again, it's a bit like what we were talking about earlier on. It's that the to some extent the British are simply doing things which they knew would be of interest to the United States, while giving the impression of being an independent actor, which, in my view, they were not really.
Can you describe American policy in the unipolar moment post 1990 or 1991?
Well, it was very clear, particularly once Bill Clinton was elected as president, that this was a unique opportunity to reshape the world. And Clinton would often give expression to the importance of creating institutions and rules and mechanisms which would be in place there and allow the United States a privileged position after it ceased to be so important in world affairs. The trouble is that that opportunity was not seized in the right way, and far too much of the unipolar moment was spent in unilateral imperial exercises, which clearly don't leave a lasting legacy. Had much more effort been put into the reform of the United Nations, the World Bank, the IMF, and all the rest of it, it might have been a very different story. It wouldn't have stopped the empire from eventually going into retreat, but it might have delayed the process.
Do you really believe that President George Bush the Elder would have invaded Iraq in 2003 like his son did? After all, he had the opportunity to do so in 1991 and chose, in retrospect, very wisely not to do so.
I don't know. And nobody knows, to be absolutely clear about that. He might have. But he might not. I'm perfectly willing to accept that that particular decision depended very much on the individuals involved, because it clearly didn't respond to any obvious national strategic interest.
Can you explicate and describe what you characterize as, quote, internal forces, unquote, which are causing the decline in the American empire as you see them?
Yes, I think it's a series of factors, the root of which is primarily economic. Empires always have citizens and subjects. And of course, the citizens are the citizens of the United States. And by tradition, it doesn't matter so much in an empire what happens to the subjects, but it matters an awful lot what happens to the citizens. In other words, the citizens must feel that they are sharing in the benefits of empire, because they are, after all, sharing in the costs. But what has happened to the U.S. economy in the last 40 years shows that many of the citizens are not sharing in the benefits of economic growth and are therefore not sharing in the benefits of empire, and certainly not in the way that they were in the first three decades after the Second World War. That has created a lot of resentment. It's led to the rise of Trumpism, if we may call it that. It's led to the rise of a movement against globalization, which is, of course, a U.S. Creation in its most recent guise. And all of this, I think, is helping to explain the internal forces that are resisting or undermining American empire.
Can you explain to the listeners the historical background of those that you label, quote, anti-expansionists, unquote?
Sorry, could you repeat that question?
Sorry. Can you go into the historical background, as you do in the book, of those that you label, quote, anti-expansionist, unquote?
Yes. Anti-expansionism is one of those anti-imperialist traditions in the United States, which was very strong in the early part of the empire, in the late 18th and 19th centuries. Then became much less significant. But today, I think it has re-emerged. Of course, its origins go back to those who feared that the larger the republic, the less democratic it would be. And therefore, the expansion of the United States across the continent was going to put in danger the Republican and Democratic basis of this new country, and risk the establishment of authoritarian tendencies. And the importance of this anti-expansionist tradition has waxed and waned over the last 250 years. But I see it reemerging now, albeit in a slightly different form.
Can it be said that the amount of government debt, in the case United States government debt, really be a very important negative variable as per the continuation of the American empire? After all, in the post-1815 period, the British Empire, or I should say the UK, had a huge government debt, more than 200% of then GDP, which did not prevent the UK exercising its hegemonic position, at least outside of Europe, between 1815 to 1914?
No, I would disagree with that, because those are the years, if you take the UK, those are the years in which the United Kingdom ran a surplus on the current account of the balance of payments almost year in, year out, allowing it to export capital to the rest of the world, which was very much what was needed in order to strengthen its imperial ambitions and all the rest of it. And so the rest of the world were in debt, if you like, to the British Empire. So if you're looking at the net position of the United Kingdom, it was very much a creditor nation in those years. And it's only when it became a debtor in net terms after the First World War, and even more so after the Second World War, that its imperial pretensions were severely undermined. It's in the case of the United States. Of course, the United States did not become a net creditor until quite late, basically in the 1890s, when you start to see strong surpluses in the balance of payments, allowing the United States to export capital relatively easily to other parts of the world, which it of course did. And it is normal for empires to be in this creditor position, because once you've become a net debtor and you start to depend on borrowing from the rest of the world, you are in a slightly weaker position. So when, as in the case of the United States, you have these large current account deficits which have to be financed by importing capital from the rest of the world, it does mean that those countries that control those credits that they are lending to the United States do get some leverage. If you look at the position of Saudi Arabia, for example, it's no longer so much based on the fact that the United States used to import oil from Saudi Arabia, because that's less important now. But it's certainly true that Saudi Arabia has provided vast amounts of credit to the United States in forms of the money that it has lent. And that gives it some leverage over U.S. policy.
So you would not agree with people like Martin Wolf of the Financial Times who argue that as long as the capital which is being imported is in American dollars, the economic effects are not that detrimental.
No, I don't agree with that because, you know, it used to be the case for the United Kingdom that everything was in sterling. But the fact is that once it went from being a creditor to being a debtor, it definitely weakened the position of the United States, of the United Kingdom. And I think in the case of the United States, it didn't really matter, not so much because it was in dollars. It didn't really matter for a time because the main sources of credit were friendly countries like Japan and West Germany, now Germany. It's a different matter today because the United States is effectively borrowing from all sorts of countries, including some that are not particularly friendly. And that, I think, makes a difference.
On page 314, you seem to imply that Russia's annexation of Crimea was caused by or connected with NATO's expansion into Eastern Europe, which is a interpretation differing from specialists like Paul Wilson or Roy Allison. Why do you have that interpretation then?
I think that I used to work with Roy Allison, so I'm very familiar with his at Chatham House. So I'm very familiar with his writings, and again, he's extremely knowledgeable. But I think in this particular case, the NATO summit in 2008, which set out a statement saying that Ukraine would become a member of NATO, really set alarm bells ringing in Russia, and therefore, and ultimately, I think was responsible for the decision of Russia, which of course is illegal under international law. No one doubts that. But it was probably that more than anything else which set Russia on the path to eventual annexation of Crimea. It's worth remembering that Crimea is where the Russian is the only significant port on the Black Sea that Russia has. It's where its nuclear submarines are based. It's not just a piece of real estate like any other. And Russia has always regarded Ukraine and indeed Crimea as being effectively just part of Russian territory. It's different from, say, Lithuania or Latvia, which have a tradition as nation states. It goes back a long time. Ukraine doesn't have that. And so Russia has looked on Ukraine, rightly or wrongly, in a rather different way to what it's looked on other parts of the former Soviet Union.
On page 359 of the book, you state that in 12 years' time, the American Empire will be, quote, a pale shadow of itself, unquote. Is that a rhetorical sleight of hand or a bit of an exaggeration?
Well, neither, I hope. Of course, I finished the draft of this book just as Donald Trump was being elected to the presidency. But everything that has happened since he has taken office suggests that the imperial retreat is accelerating. I mean, only this week, as you and I are talking, President Trump has launched an attack on two key institutions that have underpinned U.S. empire. One is NATO and the other is the WTO. And so I see the imperial retreat is accelerating under President Trump. And so I think when I say in 12 years' time, then I think far from being an exaggeration, that may be an underestimate.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
Well, the lesson I really hope that people will take away is that imperial retreat is not the same as the decline of the nation state. I'm not a declinist. I don't believe that the United States itself is in decline just because I'm talking about imperial retreat. It's really important to distinguish between the two. I point out in my book that when empires retreat, if it happens mainly for internal reasons, there's no reason why the nation state can not only survive, but can even prosper. And I give the example of France or the United Kingdom, for example, as an illustration of that. If it happens mainly for external reasons, as in the case of the Ottoman Empire or the German Empire, then it's a very different story, and the nation state will indeed suffer. And because I believe that imperial retreat in the United States is taking place mainly for internal reasons, I believe that there's all sorts of reasons why citizens of the United States, and indeed citizens of the rest of the world, can't be quite positive about this process. I think the nation state, the U.S. nation state, could indeed be strengthened by the middle of this century as a result of this long process of imperial retreat that we're currently witnessing.
Professor, I would like to thank you very much for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thank you for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much indeed.